Expanding Jacksonville's human rights ordinance to cover the LGBT community finally becomes law. Mayor Lenny Curry says he wants more equipment and money to fight gun violence, and it's a $10 billion battle for CSX stock. Some of the stories making headlines this week. Good Friday morning, and live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect on 89.9, and thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. We are always live at 9, and never miss a show. Download our WJCT app and listen anytime. Just ahead, all of the news of the week with our Friday roundtable. Get on the line now with your thoughts about the week's top stories at 549-2937. Then later, best-selling author R.L. Stine, plus the Jack's Auto Show is in town. The experts there say flying cars are in our future. That's right, all of that ahead. But first, it's Friday. Time for the weekly roundtable as we welcome Florida Times Union columnist Mark Woods. Hey, Mark.
Good morning.
Tim Gibbons, editor of the Jacksonville Business Journal.
Glad to be here.
Claire Goforth, who edits Folio Weekly.
Good morning.
And blogger Fred Matthews.
Good morning, Melissa.
So good to see all of you. Lots of news to discuss this Friday from more boardroom and corporate intrigue involving CSX to the mayor saying he's going to try a new tack to crack down on gun violence in this community. But our top story, the Jacksonville City Council this week amended the city's human rights ordinance to protect gay and transgender people from discrimination in the areas of jobs, housing, and public accommodations. The final vote was 12-6. Mayor Lenny Curry allowed it to pass into law without signing the measure. Now, the HRO vote came after a couple of failed attempts to pass this and after 5 years of activism on both sides. Our reporter Lindsay Kilbride was outside City Hall and got reaction from a number of people. Here is Rudy Alcantara standing with his partner of almost 25 years celebrating the outcome.
First time coming down here, and it passed. We've waited a long time for this, so long for this, and look at this, but it validates us, it's beautiful.
Now, Councilman Al Ferreira was against the HRO, one of six who voted no, and he made a business argument. Let's listen to him.
I'm not against anybody who's gay or transgender or anything like that. I'm not against straight people. I'm not against blacks. I'm not against anybody. But this is going to infringe with a very liquid, fluid definition of what's going to happen to somebody if they're accused of something. A business will go broke if they're innocent, just because they're accused of this because of the financial burden.
But at the same time, City Councilman Aaron Bowman, one of the co-sponsors of the bill, said business reasons are why this measure passed.
If any of you think that putting something today on a referendum that will get voted on a year and a half from now is not going to have drastic consequences to how people view our city, companies that left North Carolina, Google Venture, CoStar, PayPal, Deutsche Bank, the Charlotte Observer estimates that North Carolina has already lost, is going to lose about $5 billion a year of business on their HB2.
So we're going to begin the hour with a discussion of the passage of the HRO landmark vote in Jacksonville this week. We want your calls and comments at 549-2937. We're already getting your tweets and emails. We'll go to those in a moment. Claire Goforth, the 12-6 vote carried the day, as I said, with six opposing. They were Danny Becton, Doyle Carter, Al Ferreiro, Bill Gulliford, Sam Newby, and Matt Schellenberg. The rest of the council, with the exception of Katrina Brown, who was not present, voted yes. A big difference from 5 years ago in 2012 when the HRO saw its first go-round.
Yes, that's correct. And I mean, this is a victory for those who have been fighting for 5 years to get it back on the ballot and get it back in front of the council for a vote. I know that they have worked very hard, lobbying and trying to get public awareness and bringing other people on board, religious leaders and business interest. And, you know, they deserve to be commended for all of their efforts over these years.
Fred Matthews, what about the discussion of this possibly coming back again as a referendum in a year or two?
Well, it would be a nice thing to wish for on the conservative side, and that is something that Councilman Gulliford certainly threw out there that it's going to come back. But the question is, who's going to bring it back? And what kind of support are they going to be able to get after a vote like this today? Look, you know, a lot. that the pro-HRA folk won the war of attrition here, because it was clear from the start with the amendments that were coming down that the majority, the councilman who did not speak, Joyce Morgan and Jim Love, the president, that's who you watched in this thing. And they didn't speak. The vote was pretty much already there for them. And even, and it was interesting to see Reggie Brown from the North Side carrying the day, being the leader of this movement, and with his shield and broadsword going up against
Gulliver. Why is that interesting to you?
Because he was relatively lukewarm the last time this thing came around. I mean, he sat right next to Reggie Gaffney, who was on the edge of this thing, and I think
didn't he vote against it last time?
He voted against it, and I think he voted for one of the amendments that was brought up by the opposition here. So that's what made it interesting, but I don't think that Councilman Gulliford will bring this back again. I mean, besides that, he's in his second term, isn't he? I don't think he's going to be around to bring another one back.
And we'll go to your calls on the passage of the Human Rights Ordinance, the updated measure at 549-2937 in just a moment. Tim Gibbons, Mark Woods, this legislation did pass with a couple of amendments. One ensures that violators of the ordinance cannot be punished with jail time. The other states that, along with churches and religious institutions, some religiously affiliated nonprofits are also exempt.
Yeah, I think it'll be real interesting a year from now to look and see what has played out in the year. I predict you'll find not much. I don't think these predictions of businesses going out of business will happen. I don't think, you know, churches won't be affected. What is it, 80% of businesses are small businesses that are exempt mm-hmm. for this. I also don't think there will be many discrimination claims. So you might say a year from now, why did we do this? And I would argue it's more about symbolism.
You see this as more of a symbolic statement of support toward this community. Tim, do you agree?
It's symbolic, but it's symbolism with teeth in the idea that I agree. I don't think there will be a lot of enforcement. I've actually covered this since the very first time. What I find interesting is if you talk to both sides, nobody actually thinks there'll be massive enforcement efforts. People who opposed it said, oh, Jacksonville is already inclusive, we don't need this. People who were for it are basically saying they want employers to know that this is bad. It's an official statement, don't do this. And that honestly is enough for most people to go, okay, well, maybe if people were doing things that would violate this, they will modify their behavior. But the idea of bringing it back up for a referendum a year from now, I find interesting. One, the backlash of removing something like this would be far more than you know, people would be outraged if you tried to remove this after putting it in place. Plus, a year from now, are people going to be that worked up over it? I don't think so.
We did see that, though, in the city of Houston, Texas. Claire Goforth, what about that? Houston passed a measure like this, updating their human rights ordinance, and then a year or two later, folks in favor of a referendum to repeal it were successful.
Yeah, it certainly is an interesting question to ponder, and we'll be looking at this in the months to come. We're asking ourselves, are we the city that, you know, it's about our city's identity, really. Is Jacksonville a progressive city? Is Jacksonville a liberal city? Or is it a conservative city in the sense that it doesn't want to extend these protections to people on the basis of sexual orientation, gender identity, and expression? I think that I have hope that Jacksonville will not go that route, because I think it is reflected very poorly on the city of Houston.
You do?
I personally do. That is my opinion.
Fred?
Well, and I would tend to agree with Claire. Look, Texas is already saying to Texas in general, as a state, the legislature, the governor, already throwing out markers to the NFL and the NBA, saying don't mess with Texas, because they're considering...
It didn't stop Houston from getting the Super Bowl.
It didn't, but they didn't. But, you know, that was one city. Instead of a state, it could affect them as it did North Carolina. But again, as far as Jacksonville is concerned, I don't see it happening. Although, yes, there could be a movement to have a referendum to bring this back. But for those who would carry it, for those of us who cover the news, it would be another great event. But for Jacksonville itself, it would say volumes about where we are. Are we inclusive or not? I mean, I'm of the generation that... when I see the young man who was really on point at the city council meeting. He kept jumping up and down. I thought that he was going to get up at one point. He had this great dress on. And he had. I thought that at one point he was going to run up there and actually jump up at somebody, at Councilman Gulliford, for a minute there. As it turned out, he was just going to get an agenda. But he was up and down. He was very excited about this. That was a time when that would have, you know, said, what's going on? Well, but it's not exciting anymore. It doesn't make any difference. You are who you are, and I think that that's what we all have to settle with.
And clearly, societal consensus is moving in that direction, Mark Woods. But it was really extraordinary to see Tuesday night outside City Hall this dance party break out. And as people in favor of this were celebrating in the streets, at the same time, you saw those opposed going up and speaking, you know, being given the opportunity to be part of public comments, saying that this would lead to the ruination of the city of Jacksonville and that it would endanger women and girls in public bathrooms, even though this ordinance doesn't have anything to do with public bathrooms.
Right. To your first point, the clip you played was interesting. The person who said it validates us. I thought that was pretty powerful. And then to the second point, like I said before, I think if we look at this a year from now, I don't think Jacksonville will have changed dramatically in any way. And I'm always kind of amused the idea that like when a couple of years ago, the gay marriage debate, that it was going to ruin the argument. It's going to ruin my marriage. I did a whole column, I think, listing off I said, yes, this is a huge threat to my marriage right behind, and I listed off about 40 things that I think are probably a bigger threat to my marriage.
You mean how you don't put down the toilet seat?
I think that's a big one. I think that was one of the ones I used, yes.
That is a deal breaker.
I think I said talking, not talking.
Just know that we're always right and everything will be fine.
Yes.
Tim Gibbons.
I think that is the interesting thing. Looking out a year where people were coming up talking about this is going to be the ruination of society, it reminds me of actually on this show when you had Superintendent Beatty on here talking about how the school district deals with transgender students. And it was this quiet policy where they, you know, basically accommodate the students, and it's been going on, and nobody really knew about it. And once they did, people went nuts, but it's been happening, and the bad things that have been forecast are not happening, so it does take away that argument.
All right, let's go to your calls now as our amazing Friday Roundtable, the most popular show of the week, talks about the biggest headlines from the last several days, including the landmark vote Tuesday to update Jacksonville's human rights ordinance. What do you think? 549-2937 to join us. Let's begin with Mary in Atlantic Beach. Hi, Mary. Good morning.
Hi, Melissa. I just want to say that here in Atlantic Beach, we have an HRO already. I was very surprised at Bill Gulliford's really statement that he was representing his constituents, because honestly, I don't think so. And I just want to finish by saying, out here in Atlantic Beach, since our HRO passed, we are still the peaceable kingdom. And thanks so much for your show.
Oh, thanks, Mary. The peaceable kingdom. I didn't know that was the tagline for Atlantic Beach, but now I learned something. Thanks, Mary, for that call. The peaceable kingdom. That's true, though.
I want a T-shirt.
I know. They did have some struggle and hue and cry over the passage of their ordinance a few years ago in Atlantic Beach, but it did eventually go through.
It is ironic that one of the more conservative areas of the city, they always vote Republican, at least most of the time, and that they would be one of the first to get this done. But they are a diverse community in Atlantic Beach, Neptune Beach, all of them kind of gel together, but it's rather diverse but conservative the way they vote.
Well, I think that's one of the interesting things about this vote is it does kind of wreak havoc on the labels that we have. We talk about liberal and conservative. You know, you have Aaron Bowman, who works for the Chamber of Commerce and had a Navy career, you know, military and business leaders. Oh, they're conservative. He was lead sponsor of this bill. So this issue has mixed up labels in some way.
It's certainly the business community, which tends to lean Republican, really put their muscle behind this measure this time around. They leaned hard on these council representatives.
When you have, you know,
and they did it behind closed doors.
Both behind closed doors and openly.
It.
I mean, you have Shad Khan, you know, telling the New York Times that he wants this to pass. That sends a message.
Right. You have Darnell Smith leading the charge. I found it very interesting.
The head of the chamber.
Right.
Yeah.
So, yes, I found Tim's point we do tend to do that. Well, when I'm writing, I usually try and avoid liberal or conservative, because I think we fall into traps when we say that. And this is kind of a prime example of of a fascinating example of things playing out in our city, the business community being behind this, people who helped elect Mayor Curry, Republicans. It's the dynamics of this are fascinating.
Speaking of Mayor Curry, he allowed this to pass into law without signing it. How do you read the tea leaves on that move?
Well, it just makes sense. It's pragmatic on his part. And I was telling anyone who would listen before the vote that I thought that's what he would do if it passed and it was not veto-proof. If he had vetoed it, then he would have faced a lot of blowback on this. If he had signed it, he would have faced a lot of blowback on this. So it was really the most pragmatic thing for him to do. I would question whether or not it was the best thing to do, but that is his decision to make.
Fred.
Well, I mean, that I think Claire is exactly right. It's the best decision for him to make, especially if he's going to keep his conservative Republican credentials in place for a future run at office and not have this come back to you. The council made the decision.
Right. Everybody does help. He doesn't have the, liberals who would be upset at him. He doesn't have, I'm using the labels now. Sorry, Mark. He doesn't have, but you're right. It keeps his credentials. I also liked how, from a political theater standpoint, how quickly he acted on this.
Yeah.
There was
no suspense.
There was no second news cycle. The next day of reporters calling, what are you going to do? Previous administration, this thing would have dragged out for a week of, will he or won't he? This is okay. Here, move on.
And he even said, let's move on to the real issues. Clearly, the mayor doesn't see this as a top of mind issue. And we'll talk about some of his moves in a few minutes, the other news of the week.
Right. That was what struck me, Tim, was that he, it became the third paragraph in the story and then back to the whole story. So you effectively, you made it one piece of one day's news cycle, which these days is a little different than some things that play out that stay in the news cycle for months.
Exactly right. Well, let's go to a few more of your calls. If you're just tuning in, our Friday Roundtable is breaking down the top stories of the week right now. What are your thoughts about this big story and the other news of the week? It's 549-2937. Ed at the Beaches. Hi, Ed. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Melissa, good morning. How are you this morning?
Okay, thanks.
Appreciate you taking the call. First of all, I got 3 points to make. I wanted to do real quick. Number one, Mark, thank you for a wonderful article on Commercial Now last week. That was an excellent article.
Good job, Mark Woods, as always.
Two, thank you.
Number two, regarding the desperate argument of the bathrooms, quite frankly, I'm more comfortable with my wife and my daughters and my granddaughters in a restroom with a transgender than I would be with the president. In the same room with them. But number three, and most important one, is regarding the mayor and his refusal to sign. I guess my question is, and I guess I'm getting old, what happened to principled lawmakers and principled government people as opposed to politically expedient lawmakers? And I guess I'll just take the comments off the air.
What happened to principled leaders as opposed to politically expedient ones?
Well, they have a principle. It's their reelection.
Yeah, I mean,
right, their principle is to be politically expedient.
Yeah, that's pretty straightforward.
They're firmly committed to it.
I mean, it's pretty straightforward. I mean, that is it. I mean, he has to look at where he is. I mean, when he ran for office, he didn't say he was for this. He said it was for everybody, and everybody should be treated equally. And the first executive order he issued was to make sure that you didn't have any discrimination within city government. So he did those things. But he never, at any time, did he say he was for or against the HRO.
He said he thought it wouldn't be prudent. He said he didn't think it was necessary.
It wasn't necessary, but he didn't say he was against it.
And there's a certain amount of the most blowback that the mayor has gotten is when he does get into more political sort of things. Introducing Donald Trump did generate some heat. Something like the pension, where he can portray it as a very pragmatic, I'm just going to come in and get something done, it seems to work better. There's the old potholes don't have party affiliation sort of thing. In some ways, I think Jacksonville does not want a politically active mayor. They just want stuff to get done.
Sure. Well, speaking of that, also making headlines this week, the mayor is asking the city council to approve emergency funding for new gun identification technology. We're going to talk a little bit about the city's gun violence problem right now and the mayor's tack on trying to reduce it. Now, the Integrated Ballistic Identification System, or IBIS, uses a shell casing's fingerprint as it's called, to track down the shooter. This new tech is expected to cost the city $250,000. Curry gave a press conference where he issued a warning to would-be criminals, saying that once this technology is in place, it will be easier to find those that shot off the weapons illegally. What do you think about this? And what are your concerns about the city's homicide and gun violence rate? What do you think about this as a potential new way to address it? It's 549-2937. Mark Woods, the Florida Department of Law Enforcement already uses this technology. Local law enforcement has to send in the shell casings to the state to be analyzed. At the local level, if we had this, I guess it would streamline the investigators' work.
Right. They talked about how the combination of three different technologies that they'll have can take things that took literally months and turn around very quickly. So, I mean, in a grand scheme of a city budget, $250,000 is
not that much.
Nothing. So, I mean, it seems to me like it's worth a try. You know, see how what happens, and if they see dramatic results. You know,
I was surprised at actually how small the price tag is. I mean, you look at so many other programs, and
it costs a lot more. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And you know, we continue to be the state's murder capital, off and on.
Duval.
Not something for Duval to be proud of. So, and the mayor, of course, campaigned on a platform of public safety, restoring confidence in public safety. This continues to be a core issue for city government. Working on the homicide rate, working on making sure people in neighborhoods feel safe in their homes. This is a continuing issue for the city of Jacksonville.
Yes, it certainly is, and I think that law enforcement should have every tool that's available to them. $250,000 does not seem like a very big price tag for this. But when you look at violent crime, gun crime, a large percentage of violent crime is committed with illegal weapons. A large percentage of weapons are never recovered. So if we look at the numbers, and you know, if the percentage of murders in Jacksonville where they recover a bullet and they can identify it through the system and they cover the weapon, we're probably looking at best a handful of murders that this may solve, but that's a victory. But you know, the reality is this is not just going to solve our murder problem.
Sure.
Well, I mean, the bullet ID system, I guess, is a great thing, and you're right, $250,000 is not a drop in the bucket for all we have to deal with. But I think that what many people are looking forward to is the same thing and it's not rather interesting that this idea comes from the mayor and not from the sheriff's office. I'm assuming they had a long discussion about this before he proposed it to give the sheriff something that he didn't ask for. I don't recall the sheriff asking for this deal here. But, I mean, again, it can work. But until we get to the serious roots of crime in our community, we're going to continue to play around the edges. And this is, again, another play around the edges. You're going to ID bullets. When are we going to get to the root of the issue? When are we going to face down what Chicago has to face down eventually if they're going to solve the problem there? Are we willing? Do we have the nerve to go and face down the gangs that are polluting our neighborhoods, that are polluting zip codes 7, 8, and 9, and 18? Are we willing to do the work to get that done? That's not necessarily a police job. If the mayor wants to do something here, and he's been told this, if he would ever meet with the SCLC and the NAACP, and yes, that national black party that works around the fringes here, that if you really want to do something, you're going to have to confront the demons that are actually in the neighborhoods that are causing this issue.
And do you believe that the ongoing anti-crime initiative, the Jacksonville Journey, which has sort of waxed and waned in this city since the Peyton administration, do you think it is making a dent in this problem?
If it can get support, and if it can get, what do you call, they call them agents that you have with social service agencies, you actually have to get people in the field to look at what's happening in the neighborhoods. And there are some examples that Jacksonville has had with that before, but again, it got disbanded when somebody thought it was, you know, it was like midnight basketball. Why should we be doing that? Well, it proved to be a nice way to keep them from doing something else at midnight when they don't have anything else to do. So that's where we are. But I mean, again, this is a good idea. I mean, idea and bullets, but the fact of the matter is exactly what Claire said. Most of the guns are stolen. Most of these people don't buy the guns out of the gun shop. They're stealing it from your house, from out of those unlocked cars in Mandarin. The people still refuse to lock their cars, so they leave the guns in there. The cop got his stolen the other couple of months ago, you know. So, I mean, that's where they get the gun from. So you got to ID the bullet and find it belongs to the cop.
Honestly, an anti-crime initiative to tell people to lock their car doors, honestly, would not be a mess. It's interesting. You mentioned the Jacksonville Journey, and is the challenge of the entire point of those programs has been a long-term transformational sort of thing. So you take a kid...
Strengthening communities, strengthening families.
Right, and have it pay off 15 years from now.
Yeah.
The problem is that you pay it month by month or year by year to get the benefit two administrations later, and it's easy to cut those programs when you're not seeing it fixing something tomorrow.
And this is not an easily or quickly fixed issue. This is a long-term battle for, as you said, Fred, for neighborhoods, for reclaiming neighborhoods that are struggling with all of these socioeconomic problems, poverty, violence, family breakdown. Mark Woods.
Right. Ron Littlepage's column this morning mentions how he sat in that same room and listened to some of the same things. Obviously, it wasn't about this technology, but this idea we've got a problem, we're upset, and we've got to do something. And how many mayors have said this? And as you pointed out when you introduced this segment, that was a big part of Mayor Curry's campaign, that public safety, that, you know, that's why Alvin Brown needed to go, was, you know, the city wasn't safe enough. So I think, you know, he will also, if that's how he wanted the previous administration to be judged, he also will be
judged. He'll have to be judged as well,
right.
Sure. Okay, let's go to Chuck at the Beaches. Hi, Chuck.
Hi, guys. I just wanted to touch on the gun violence thing. You have to teach social skills. If you started today, and I've said this on your show before, if you started today in kindergarten and you could bring... and you could hire counselors, and you could call in Martin Luther King, and you could bring them in, and you could teach, even though people don't have money, and even though they're poor, you can teach people, like Martin Luther King taught people, you can teach people to turn the other cheek. You can teach them social skills. You can teach them how to be productive in their community. And if you started today, and you put the counselors in the schools, and you started teaching these kids, and you spent an hour a week, by the time they got to be 13 or 14, it's possible that you could endear them to being a benefit in their community. And if you could turn 50% of the kids away from gun violence, that would be wonderful. You have the capacity to do it. You have the place to do it. You just have to teach the social skills. I'm an NRA firearms instructor, and they always teach de-escalate. Never go down the wrong road. You have to teach social skills. We don't do it in Duval County. We never had. My kids have graduated from school here. We have the capacity to do it. We used to do home economics. What's wrong with teaching our kids social skills? Thank you.
All right, Chuck. Thanks for that call. Lots of calls this morning as we discuss the top stories of the week with our Friday roundtable. And we want to make note of an important business story in boardroom intrigue worthy of Game of Thrones. A $10 billion battle for CSX is actually happening as we speak. CSX, of course, the railroad giant headquartered right here in Jacksonville. And I'm quoting here from Fortune magazine, Hunter Harrison, a 76-year-old railroading legend. First of all, I didn't know the railroad business had legends, but if there is a legend in the railroad business, of course his name is Hunter Harrison.
It
sounds like a movie character. Well, Hunter Harrison is trying to wrest away control of CSX and become the CEO of the company. He's demanding an epic pay package and full boardroom control. Tim Gibbons, how do you see this incredible boardroom intrigue shaking out?
Can you come and narrate all of our stories?
I mean, it's fascinating. I mean, I think railroads don't sound really sexy or exciting, but this story kind of is.
It is. There's a lot of back and forth. Hunter Harrison is a railroad legend. He's taken three railroads and turned them around, made them much more efficient. CSX has been fighting to get more efficient over the past several years and has made some really good steps, but the idea of somebody coming in who's viewed as being able to push that faster will be interesting. Part of the flip side of that, though, is efficiency can mean job losses. So it will be interesting to see who comes in. CSX is one of the larger employers in Jacksonville, obviously has workers across the country or across the Eastern Seaboard. it will be interesting to see how many of those lose their job in that quest for efficiency.
Yeah, we'll have to follow it. But apparently a shareholder vote is coming soon in mid-March.
Well, there's a special shareholder meeting where they can weigh in on basically the board and Harrison, the hedge fund supporting him, have not been able to come to terms. So They're basically looking for shareholder input. When Hunter Harrison took over Canadian National, they had a proxy fight then, same sort of thing, and the hedge fund backing him then won. So it'll be interesting to see what happens here.
All right, we'll continue to follow it. And
you put that in Game of Thrones terms? Yeah.
Well, somebody's getting their head cut off.
Exactly.
Yeah, the hook for us will be whether the headquarters stays in Jacksonville after the dust settles.
And do you think there's a possibility it could move?
There's a possibility it could move.
What do you think, Tim?
There's always a possibility, but it Harrison doesn't have ties to some other city where it would obviously move to. I'm trying to remember, I think he grew up in Illinois. I know he worked for the railroad who was based there. So there's no obvious other point to come to. It does occur to me he is coming now from Canada. I don't know if there's a White Walker reference we could fit in there.
Winter is coming.
Yeah, really. Okay, finally, it's our look at the strange, bizarre, and just plain ridiculous from around the state. Luckily, there is never a shortage of material. Here it is for you right now, only in Florida. And only in Florida does a man try to blow up buildings just so he can buy some cheap stock. Yeah, Mark Barnett of Ocala made at least 10 explosive devices in hopes of blowing up Target stores all along the East Coast as part of an elaborate and deadly scheme to buy cheap stocks of the company.
Retail stocks are battered anyhow.
I know. But Barnett, here's what he did. He was charged with possession of a destructive device and faces 10 years in federal prison after police found he concocted a plan to place explosives disguised as food items in Target stores all up and down the East Coast, from Florida all the way to New York. His thinking was that his plot to blow them up would cause stock prices to plummet for Target and he could buy some cheap shares.
Well, they are an easy target.
And only in Florida does a woman call 911 after getting locked inside a CVS store. This is actually, this would be my nightmare. Christian Hathaway from St. Cloud, Florida says she was shopping inside a CVS at 9 o'clock when she suddenly realized she was all alone. Security gates had come down over the doors and the clerks had gone home. Her only way out was to call 911. They finally got her out, but yeah, that would be a little creepy.
So where is St. Cloud?
I have no idea.
It's by Kissimmee.
Where is that?
By Orlando.
South of Orlando.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, there you go.
So don't go shopping there, I guess, is the takeaway.
And thanks to our panel, Fred Matthews, Mark Woods, Claire Goforth, and Tim Gibbons. So good to see you. Thanks for being here, and have a great weekend.
Thank you, Melissa.
All right, thank you.
We'll be right back.
Hendricks Avenue Baptist Church is a place to experience Christ's presence and God's Spirit in a vibrant faith community. HAB celebrates diversity, seeks to bridge differences, and journeys together in an honest and authentic search for truth. HABchurch.com. Find a different way of being Baptist.
The Samsung phone that was recalled due to a battery failure, it's the same lithium-ion battery type that powers most of our electronic devices. I'm Ira Flatto on the next Science Friday. We look into the power of batteries. Are there safer, faster alternatives out there? The answer will shock you. Plus, a battery makeover for electric vehicles. All on Science Friday from PRI.
Fridays at 2 on 89.9 WJCT.
On Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, we are not afraid to ask the big questions, even to the guy who owns the Chicago Cubs.
Well, there's a few people that just misunderstand something about, like, why beer costs $9 or something like that.
Why does beer cost $9?
Why does a starting pitcher cost $25?
We're worth what you pay for us, which is nothing. Join us for the News Quiz from NPR. Saturday and Sunday mornings on 89.9 WJCT.
Take a drive with us into the Blues Horizon every Monday and Wednesday night at 11. The best in classic and modern blues as part of WJCT's After Hours. Every Monday and Wednesday night at 11 on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world, your music.
Welcome back. Well, he's the best-selling author of the Goosebumps Empire of Kids books. Maybe your kids love them. R.L. Stein is paying a spine-tingling visit to Fernandina Beach to speak this weekend at the Amelia Island Book Festival. I spoke with Stein about how he became one of the top-selling children's authors in history. R.L. Stein, a pleasure. Thanks for being with us.
Well, thank you, Melissa. Very nice to talk to you.
You are the author of hundreds of books and have incredibly devoted fans, including my own kids, the king of the Goosebumps Empire. So much excitement that you'll be at the Amelia Island Book Festival. It's my understanding the event around your appearance might even be sold out. There's so much interest.
Well, that's nice. We like to sell out. I always like that.
Absolutely. And so it's your mission to give kids the creeps. How did you get started on this incredible literary journey?
Yes, I love to scare kids. And I get paid for it. That's the amazing thing.
Exactly.
When you get really old, people start giving you awards.
And now you're getting tons of them.
Lifetime Achievement Awards for scaring kids. It's amazing, right?
Yeah. How did you come up with Goosebumps?
Well, I was doing a series. Everything that ever happened to me was like by accident or somebody else thought of it. I never planned to be scary, ever. I always wanted to be funny.
Hmm.
And I actually wrote about 100 joke books for kids before I got scary.
Really?
And I did a humor magazine for 10 years called Bananas. I was just a funny guy.
Uh-huh.
And then one day I was having lunch with the editor at Scholastic, and she had had a fight with a guy who wrote teen horror novels. And she said, "I'm not working with him anymore. You could do a good teen horror novel. Go home and write a book called Blind Date."
Hmm.
And gave me the title. I said, "Sure, no problem." I didn't know what she was talking about, right?
Hmm.
And I wrote this, went home. I spent like 3 months. I wrote this book, Blind Date, and it was a number one bestseller.
Wow. And you just literally came up with the plot just on the spot like that?
Yeah, well, no, I didn't. I had to run to the bookstore and buy a bunch of teen horror books and see what it was, see what people were doing, and then try to figure out what I could do.
It's still amazing that you were able to come up with a whole new genre, like write so well in a whole new genre like that.
Well, that's what I do. That's like my only talent. You can ask my wife. That's the only thing I do well.
But look how well you're doing it. I mean, you're the best-selling children's author in history.
If you overlook J.K. Rowling.
Right. You're in Rowling territory.
She passed me by quite a bit. But anyway, it's wonderful. These books just caught on. We did a series called, and I'm still doing it, Fear Street for Teenagers, which was teen terror. And then my wife and her business partner came to me, they're my editors, and said, "We should try to scare younger kids. Let's try to do a younger series." And that's how Goosebumps got started.
Now, it's my understanding you're venturing into Marvel Comics, too.
This was a lifelong dream of mine. When I was a kid, I was a huge comics fan. When I was a kid, there were all these really scary comics, like, you know, Tales from the Crypt, and the Vault of Horror, which I just loved. And a while ago, I got a call from an editor at Marvel who said, "Would you like to take one of our characters and do a series of comic books?" It's like, you know, I said, "Yeah, I sure would." And they sent me a list of all these characters, and I picked, I love swamp monsters.
Mm-hmm.
I wrote a Goosebumps book last year called Here Comes the Shaggity. It was about a swamp monster. And so I picked this really ugly character they had called Man-Thing. And I'm doing a 5 comic book series of Man-Thing. It's been fun.
You are having fun with this, I can tell.
Yeah.
What advice do you have for all the budding authors that are going to come out to the Amelia Island Book Festival?
I never give advice to authors. Because I figure if they're really going to be serious about it, they're going to be like me. Like, I started writing when I was 9, and I knew I wanted to be a writer. And I think young writers, they know to read a lot, and they know to write something every... They don't need me to tell them to write or to read, because they have it in them. It's this weird thing that, you know, makes people write. So I never give advice.
Well, and you certainly are going to be someone, advice or not, that people are so excited to see in person. Best-selling author R.L. Stein giving us a few minutes. Thank you so much for joining us, and have fun while you visit the island.
Oh, it's great. I've never been there. I'm just looking forward to it. I'll be down there tomorrow afternoon. So thanks, Melissa. I really enjoyed talking to you.
Thank you. That's best-selling author R.L. Stein. His talk at the Amelia Island Book Festival is actually sold out, but check out the festival on the island this weekend. And we'll be right back.
Manchester by the Sea has been nominated for 6 Oscars, including Best Picture, Best Director, and Best Original Screenplay. On the next Fresh Air, we hear from the film's director and screenwriter, Kenneth Lonergan. Join us weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
I'm Christian McBride. Next time on Jazz Night in America, birthers, truthers, reptilians. Oh my. Darcy James Argue takes on the history of conspiracy theories with his jazz suite, Real Enemies.
We are living in a very paranoid time. We are all susceptible to it.
Tune in on Jazz Night in America.
Saturdays at 8 p.m. and Thursdays at 11 p.m. on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
The very best of modern folk and acoustic alternative music tonight on String Theory. Listen to String Theory this evening at 11 p.m. on 89.9 WJCT. Tune in, find out.
Welcome back. Well, finally this hour, the Jacksonville International Auto Show opens today at the Prime Osborne Convention Center, and it will showcase the latest in vehicle technology, including something you might think is only a scene out of The Jetsons or a Harry Potter movie? Flying cars. Yes, they are in our future, even our near future. I swear to God. We're joined now by auto show promoter Barbara Putney. Barbara, good to see you.
Thanks for having me here.
And we'll talk about all the star cars that will be on the floor at the auto show in a minute. But first, I got to ask you, really? Flying cars are coming soon?
Not that soon.
Not that soon.
Not that soon. But all of the automation that is going on in cars now are the future that make up those
sure.
Jetson cars.
So driverless cars, obviously, that is in the pipeline where you can get in a car and it will drive you where you need to go. You don't have to physically get behind the wheel yourself.
That is coming.
That's coming too.
That is coming. But you have to think about right now, a lot of that technology is in the vehicle. But you have to watch out for things like, what if it's sun glare? The cameras are reading the lines in the road. That's what's keeping you steady, keeping the car going without you doing anything. But sun glare can cause the camera to not react right. So they're working on those things. So we're still talking about being maybe 5 years away. But however, all of those features exist in some way. Lane departure warning, which is in the vehicles now, blind spot monitoring. Many of these things are in, they started out in luxury vehicles. Now they're in your everyday cars.
And so as we look to a future where the driverless technology becomes more mainstream, how big a leap is it from that to flying cars? And what's the timetable for those to become commonplace, and we'd actually see that regularly?
Well, flying cars are still way off. You've got to view the idea, you know, right now, electric and hybrid cars are what's here. Hydrogen fuel cell cars will be coming forward. To fly, then you're getting involved in FAA. That might take a lot more.
But the prototypes exist, don't
they? They do.
And they will come. And will there be anything like that at the auto show people could look at?
Not a flying car. You know, at the auto show, you're going to find the real vehicles that you can get for 2017, 2018, what's coming down the line in the short term. But the technologies, as they explain them to you, will help you understand what's going to be there in 2020, which is when you might see driverless cars on the road.
That's pretty wild to think about, but it is on our doorstep. Now, tell us about some of the other big attractions at the auto show. These are debuts fresh from Detroit and oversees the latest in auto trends and tech. What are some of the big attractions?
Well, that's what you're going to find. Right now, what you're going to see is vehicles are getting bigger because people want the comfort. SUVs, whether they're mid-size crossovers to full-size SUVs, that's the trend. And in fact, for Jacksonville, it's a big truck market here. So that's what you're seeing at the show. So that's one of the trends going on. Again, all of these automated features are a trend that's coming in the future. And people want cars to express their personality. Color changes are coming in your future. Jewel tone colors are starting to emerge, and you're going to see more of that happening.
And why is that, do you think?
Self-expression. You know, people want to be different from one another. You want to see something
a little bit
different.
So we're going to see some unusually colored cars?
You're going to see a lot more blues coming out, jewel tone blues. You're going to see incredibly bright yellows. You know, the reds are getting redder, not the
So there are more midlife crises occurring. Is that what you're telling me?
Definitely. Definitely.
And this is one way to work through that. Okay. So there will also be some ride and drive events.
That's right. Well, one of the great things about the auto show, you can do all your research online and find lots of information. But how comfortable is that car? You know, how do you feel when you're behind the wheel? Where are the mirrors? Well, we have ride and drives at the show from Chevrolet, from Toyota, from Fiat, Chrysler, Dodge, Jeep, Ram. So it's worth taking a test drive and see how you feel behind the wheel. Then you can decide if you're interested in buying a new car.
And you just mentioned to me a minute ago before we went on the air, most of the people that come to the show aren't really going to buy a car. They just want to look and have fun.
That's right. It's a place to dream. About a third of the people are actually attending to buy a vehicle. But another third are coming because one day I want to own that Mercedes. Here you can go in and sit in those Mercedes. You wouldn't believe the amount of selfies that go on at the show.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because this is what I'm going to have one day.
One day, yes. What do you drive, by the way?
I drive a Cadillac.
Why am I not surprised? Because she's, of course, the promoter of the Jacksonville Auto Show, which has been coming to town now for, gosh, how many years?
This is our 31st year. It's
a long tradition. And it's coming up, opens up actually today through Sunday.
That's right.
At the Prime Osborne Convention Center, the 31st annual Jacksonville Auto Show. You can walk up and buy tickets, head downtown, check it out, and have a good time. Get those selfies in and dream a little. She's Barbara Pudney with the Jacksonville Auto Show. So good to see you.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for being here. Well, that's our show today. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Kevin Merschart. Michelle Corum runs the board. The show theme composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chevchik. Never miss a show. Download the WJCT app and listen anytime. And we always want your feedback. Emails go to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Next on 1A, the weekly news roundup. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT-FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. Monday. Have a great weekend.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.